This tape, part of the professional library produced by the National Professional Development Committee of the Public Relations Society of America, is a conversation with Edward L. Bernays about the professional practice of public relations. Dr. Bernays, acknowledged as the father of professional counsel on public relations, laid down the principles, practices, and ethics of the profession he founded and named in his book, Crystallizing Public Opinion, in 1923. He pioneered many areas of practices, strategies, tactics, and themes, and is responsible for numerous national movements, social beliefs, and trends. In great part, because of his writings, teachings, and lecturing, public relations became a profound influence in the United States and the free world. In partnership with his wife, Doris Fleischman Bernays, for over a half a century, he advised presidents of the United States, U.S. government departments, educational institutions, newspapers, periodicals, broadcasting systems, industrial and financial organizations, foundations, associations, and individuals on relations with the public. At 89 years of age, he has become a legend in his lifetime. There are few public relations professionals who have counseled clients for close to 60 years. Ed Bernays shared his experiences and philosophies with Cindy Strauss, a public relations counselor with her own firm in Boston, and Frank T. Labatt, second vice president of public issues at John Hancock Mutual Life Insurance Company.
Hello, I'm Cindy Strauss, and I'm sitting in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the living room of Dr. Edward L. Bernays with Frank Labatt.
Edward, we'd all like to know how you got started in the public relations counseling business.
Well, when I got out of college, I did what most young men at that time did. They did what their father wanted them to do.
And now that's a switch.
Pardon?
That's a switch from today's times.
Absolutely. And I went on this produce exchange for a few weeks, pressed letters in books, because at that time they had no carbon paper. And pretty soon I tired of that. And one day, you know, you press letters carbon, instead of carbon paper, they used letter presses. And one day I met an old classmate of mine from high school, and he said, "Ed, how'd you like to be an editor of a medical paper?" And I said, "I'd love it," because I'd always been interested in communications. I'd been on my college paper, and I'd been on my high school paper, and I'd been on my camp paper.
Where did you go to college, Eddie?
Cornell.
Cornell?
Cornell University. And he said, "Well, come ahead," and I gave up the job, despite my father's protests. After all, I was an old man then of 20. And I became an editor of the Dietetic and Hygienic Gazette and wrote editorials on the beauty of the Saturday night bath, which was a great distinctive pleasure at the time. People only bathed on Saturday night in those days. This was 1913-12. And so, while I was an editor of this paper and an associate editor of another called the Medical Review of Reviews, an actor called Richard Bennett sent in a story of a play he was going to produce called Damaged Goods. It was the first play about syphilis and its dangers. And I wrote I was interested in all kinds of social affairs, not societal affairs, but social affairs that had to do with a better society. And so I wrote Bennett and said, the editors of the Medical Review of Review will be glad to support you in your effort to produce this play. Because at that time, there was a man in New York, Anthony Comstock, who fought anything having to do with anything that might be considered to be slightly off color. And venereal disease was more than off color. It couldn't be mentioned in any society, polite or otherwise.
Very bold undertaking for that period, really.
So I wrote to this actor, who was the father of Joan Bennett, whom you've seen on the screen, and signed it the editors. I'd learned that from the Atlantic Monthly, which always signed its letters, the editors. And next morning, there was a telephone call from Richard Bennett, will you come up to the Lambs Club and have lunch with me? I want to talk to the editors. And I said, I'm the editors. So I came up and had lunch with him. And after that lunch, we decided, or I decided, and my associate, who was 22 years old, agreed, that we would organize the Medical Review of Review Sociological Fund. We would charge $4 for admission to the fund, and that, the $4, would give you the opportunity to see Damaged Goods performed by Richard Bennett and a company. And in order to build up this, to have status in New York at the time, we got John D. Rockefeller, Jr., who was interested in fighting venereal disease, and Abram Flexner and others to become members of the Medical Review of Review's Sociological Fund. And before we knew it, this performance went on. And incidentally, I found out later by looking at the list of those who were present that Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his wife, Eleanor, were present.
Were both in the audience.
Were both in the audience. And this play, which was performed in New York at the Gaiety Theater, made such a terrific sensation that next day, the newspapers were full of it, and one man sagely observed, it has struck 6 o'clock in America. At this point...
What year was this?
1913. At this point, next day, Mr. Bennett came to us and said, thanks, boys, for having done this play for us, and walked away with it. He had the rights to it, and he became a very wealthy man from our having done this beau geste to virtue, and as a result, the Social Hygiene Society was formed, and it completely, I would say, changed the picture of America towards venereal disease and what to do with it. And this action of ours gave me such a great thrill at the time, after all, I was about 20, that I decided to leave medical editing, which I wasn't suited for anyway, and go to the stage, much to the consternation of my family, and produce other plays and do the same with them. And I wrote a letter to the people in the telephone yellow book. There was a yellow book then, the theatrical producers, and told them that I had helped produce Damaged Goods, and within 24 hours, I got a bid from the largest theatrical producer to become a publicity man for some of his important plays. I didn't know what salary to ask because I'd never had much of a salary. I'd gotten $25 a week as editor. I'd gotten $25 a week from the sociological fund for working, and that was about it. So I asked for the highest sum I could think of, which was $75 a week. And that was 1913, and that kept getting better and better, and before I knew it, I was a partner in a Metropolitan Musical Bureau that Otto Kahn of the Metropolitan Opera House wanted to form. And before I knew it, he asked me to handle Diaghilev and the Russian Ballet with Nijinsky, and we helped change the attitude toward dance in America and the attitude towards color and design. Bax did the costumes, and it made a terrific dent.
How do you think you helped change the attitude towards dance?
Well, the attitude toward dance was changed because we emphasized the vigorous and virile Russian dancers who danced in these exciting Russian dances of putting their legs out and showing terrific virility. And by projecting that, the public, which had thought dancing was a woman's pursuit that no he-man would ever enter, modified its complete attitude towards the dance. Well, as a result of that, we also became managers of Caruso, and I went on tours with Enrico Caruso, and we helped to arrange trains that came in from surrounding territories to hear him. And the fascinating thing to me at the time was that only his records had been sold and displayed. Obviously, there was no radio at that time, but just the majesty of what I called his organ-lined voice just filled the halls all over the country. Well, with that kind of activity as a partner in the Metropolitan Musical Bureau, the war came along, and I decided, like most young men of the period, that the United States had to become victorious, that freedom, equality, and orderly justice were basic to the world, that the Kaiser was a man who tried to impose his will of not only upon his neighbors, but on would do that to the whole world. And I enlisted in the in George Creel's Committee on Public Information. George Creel had been a muckraking newspaper man in Denver. He had come to President Wilson with the idea that communication was an important element in building up the morale of the United States, in winning over the neutrals, and in deflating the morale of the enemy. and that was entrusted to a group of individuals whom Creel gathered. The interesting thing about the Foreign Press Bureau, of which I was a member, was that I was the only individual in it who had ever practiced communication as a profession. One of them, the head of it, was Ernest Poole, who had been a great novelist who wrote The Harbor. Another had been a great scholar at Columbia. There were a few newspaper men, but there were no professional, publicists at the time. That was an entirely new field that had only come into being after the late 19th century, when the big business engaged what were known as whitewashers to fight back the Christian socialists and the new labor groups and the square deal of Theodore Roosevelt and others. So that this gave me free play to do things like, as a gesture of goodwill to the Italians, name an American ship the Piave, which was going over to give them material. Or I can show them to you later, like getting out cards showing Americans marching to the ships, which were then distributed across the lines to show the enemy that we were coming, you see, that America was coming.
Now, did this wartime experience help you to crystallize your thinking in terms of what the public relations function is?
Frank, you've absolutely hit it on the head. The wartime experience was a very revealing one in what communications can do. In fact, when one of the members of the group, I went over with Wilson to the peace conference, when one of the members went to the group to Italy, he came back and reported that the Italian peasants worshipped two pictures in their peasant homes. One was the Virgin Mary, and the other was Woodrow Wilson, President of the United States. When Wilson came, I had a maid in an apartment we had, and she said to me, could she have the afternoon off? She wanted to see Les Bienfaiseurs de l'Humanité, the well-doer of humanity. She had been impressed with the words that had affected not only her, but neutrals all over the world, that had broken up Russia, that finally broke up Germany. And these words had such an impact that after the war, the historian said, words won the war. And it wasn't until somewhat later that they said, and lost the peace, because the actions by Wilson had not been harnessed with the words and taken into account with them.
Do you feel that that was a factor in the failure of the peace effort?
Oh.
The lack of direct public relations support for what he was trying to do?
Absolutely. What happened was George Creel left, and they put the thing into the hands of George Bob Baker, who was in Paris as the public relations representative of the president, and Baker had never had any experience in that, and obviously it was all bungled up, and Henry Cabot Lodge Sr. then fought the League of Nations, and the whole thing came to pieces. When I got back from Europe, I recognized that what we had done in peace in wartime could be harnessed to peacetime pursuits. And there were no publications in the field. There was no organization in the field. If there were anybody that did publicity, nobody knew about it because the newspapers weren't going to mention it. Certainly editor and publisher wasn't going to mention it. And you were a single person doing this pretty much by yourself without any pitiless publicity or anybody to say you nay or say you yes. So when I came back, I was retained by the War Department for the reemployment of ex-servicemen, and then I was retained by the Lithuanians, Americans of Lithuanian descent, to work for the freedom and recognition of Lithuania by the United States. This was part of the policy of Wilson's 14 points, and Lithuania was an ethnic entity on the Baltic that deserved to be free, an anti-communist bulwark in Europe. And before we knew it, Lithuania was declared free and independent and remained that way until Russia took her back in World War II. Well, we first called our work Publicity Direction for the first
publicity
year.
Direction.
Publicity Direction, because we felt that what we would do, we would direct your attitude to get publicity, you see.
Mm-hmm.
However, we soon found that the two words publicity direction were misnomers, because a person might get a lot of publicity as a result of what we told him. But if every action of his was not consistent, something else he might do would hurt the public visibility that he got.
So the concept of actions underlying good public relations began at that time to emerge.
That came to emerge after years, the fact that publicity direction was wrong, that words might have won the war, but they lost the peace, and again, in private practice, words were not enough. So we changed what we did, and I decided with a young woman who was not then my wife, but who was working with me and whom I later married and who became my partner for 58 years. And at that time, I might add, relations between young people were very remote. If you took a girl's arm across the street, she thought she was being raped. And today, situations are slightly different, as you know. Well, we then decided to call the activity Council on Public Relations. We took the word council from law. This was to be advice, not given for you to get publicity, but advice given to you on the actions you should take vis-a-vis every public upon whom you depended for viability. And that would mean in a hotel, the attitude of the porter who greeted you at the door. It would mean the attitude of the bellboy who took your bag. It would mean the attitude of the hotel clerk. It would mean the telephone service you got. It would mean the fact that the foods were served hot and not cold. And it would take in every point of contact of the hotel and the publics upon which it was dependent. And words were only an ancillary action to the total.
Now, public relations council was a phrase that you used in the book Crystallizing Public Opinion, I think, in 1923.
After we had done that, I decided that in a finance capitalist society, money was not necessarily the prime element in gaining acceptance for an idea. But there were two other ideas that would gain acceptance. One was a university. If a university adopts something in a finance capitalist society, that indicates recognition that's more than Mr. J. Pierpont Morgan dropping some dollars into your hat. So I went to New York University and said, "We have written a book. Will you have a course on this subject, which is an important and vital subject?" And they were willing to do it, and so I gave the first course in public relations. I still have the little folders upstairs that talk about it as a course in studying public opinion, how it functions, how to adjust to it, how to inform and educate the public after you have adjusted to it.
And this was in 1923?
In 23. And at the same time that I did that, we had a client who was a very potent new publisher who wanted to be innovative, and I said, "Horace Livewright, he published George Moore, and he published one of my uncle's works, which we had translated at the time."
By the way, you're referring, of course, to Sigmund Freud, who was your
introductory
uncle. At what point did you arrange to publish his works in this country?
Well, it was a fascinating experience. One of the members of the group, the Committee on Public Information in Paris, said, "I'm going down to Vienna to open up Vienna." And I said, "Well, if you open up Vienna to the Western world," Vienna was on the other side of the battlefront, "I wish you would take down a box of cigars to my uncle. I know he likes cigars, and I know he hasn't gotten any because the German blockade stopped the Cuban cigars from coming in." So he took a box of cigars down there. He was welcomed by my uncle at 19 Berggasse. And when this young man came back from his trip, he had a book. And the book was a book in German, the introductory lectures to psychoanalysis. And when I got back to the United States in March of 1919, I wrote to my uncle, and at that time it took at least, about 2 months for a letter to get back and forth, because there were no airplanes, and shipping was slow, and the mails had been disarranged. And he said, I said, "We'd like to translate it for you." And he said, "Yes." And the fascinating thing is that this was the period of the great inflation in Vienna, when all of his life insurance was worth nothing.
Maybe we can pick up this part here about the inflation.
The inflation had come to Vienna. My wife went over there in about 1923, and she found that the streetcar conductors had huge bags around their necks, their shoulders, and these bags held crowns, bunches of them. Each bunch went for one fare.
To cover the fare.
To cover the fare. The crown had been worth so little that thousands of dollars worth of insurance was worth nothing. And this book that fortuitously had been sent from Vienna to Paris to me at the peace conference, and I have letters to that effect from my uncle, saved the whole life of the family in that period because the royalties kept coming in. And the interesting thing, talk about letters, to show how cockeyed the world is when it comes to money, these letters were sent to me, and I had a Vermont office manager who saved everything because he was a thrifty Vermonter. When I came up here, the Library of Congress found that I had a lot of letters and wanted to have them. So I went down to the cellar, and here I found 40 letters from my uncle that he sent me in this intervening period, and they were worth $125,000 that he just left there by mistake. Or not by mistake, by good Vermont care.
Well, let's get back to the counseling for a minute. You said that in 1923 you coined the phrase Public Relations Council. And you were mentioning one of the clients that if you went to a hotel, you know, the counseling, it wasn't just the actions had to speak, you had to counsel on the actions and the activities. How has that changed?
I would say that fortunately, in certain corporations, it has not changed, and it has been intensified. I did a number for Howard Penn Hudson of the Public Relations Quarterly, and I asked about 25 of the leading American industrialists, from the head of General Motors to the head of American Tell and Tell, John Hancock, Mutual Life Insurance Company, and others, to tell me what the social significance of public relations was to them. And to my delight, I noted that a number of them came back. Murphy of General Motors, for instance, said that public relations, you saw that number.
Well, yes, indeed. Very well done.
Public relations is one of our most important policy-making functions. We regard it as one of the basic elements in the carrying forward of our business. And that was echoed practically by and large. The interesting thing to me was, in that same number, that I asked university professors about public relations, and they had much less of a knowledge and understanding of what it really was than the top
Godhead symbols of American finance capitalism. Many of them thought it was skill in writing. Many of them thought it was what I would call sublimated press agentry. Many of them regarded it as simply publicity to inform and to persuade the public without regard to action being the underlying element in any sound public relations.
What knowledge and skill do you feel a true professional public relations person should have?
Well, I always insisted, when we had a whole office building, not a huge building, but a four-story building in New York, I always insisted that I never wanted to get writers, because writers always emphasize the word instead of emphasizing reality. And a good writer would let his imagination go. What I wanted was applied social scientists. I wanted people who knew psychology, who knew social psychology, who knew anthropology, who knew sociology, who knew something about linguistics, who knew something about semantics, but who by and large had a sense of human knowledge and human values. And I felt that that was much more important than being able to write, because I wasn't interested in writing. I was interested in action. Is this company fair and honest to its dealers? Does this company deal correctly with its stockholders? Does this company put the proper emphasis on the gifts that it gives to society as a whole in return, but for instance, like Exxon does?
Well, when you get a new client, how do you analyze those problems and opportunities?
When I get a new client, I first of all make reasonably sure that he will feel a certain equivalence at the pain he has to undergo in retaining us. In other words, we no longer do this the way publicity men used to do it for $125 a week. They compared themselves with what newspaper people got. We decided, first of all, to put our services on the basis of a lawyer's, except they were more important than the lawyer's, because the lawyer only deals with precedent and the law, and a good public relations person will help to establish precedent, which is much more important than simply following precedent. We also tried to inform the particular client on the ramifications of the activity that we were going into. If there were, after my book was published, I would give the client a copy of my book so that he could see this not as dealing, let's say, with purveyors or dealing with the public, but he could see this in its entirety.
This was a way to help establish your credibility as well.
That's right. So the credibility was established by the fee. The client had a certain amount of pain that he wanted to gratify in accepting us. It was gratified by giving him basic material, the more authoritative, the better. Later on, we could give him additional material because material was written on the social sciences, so that he didn't regard this as somebody coming along and telling him what to do that he didn't want to do, or that was an attack on his ego because he hadn't thought of it himself.
But how do you persuade top management or those people that you work for to adopt a change?
Well, if a management pays you a good amount, they will pretty soon carry out your wishes because they want to get an equivalence. What you tell them that they haven't already believed is no longer an attack on their ego. It's something that they're getting for what they're paying for. In other words, if you go to a doctor and he tells you to take a green pill, you take a green pill regardless of what's in it. And in this case, if they go to a man whom they pay a good fee to, they will do what he wants because they want to get an equivalent for their money.
But they could say, we paid for that, and that's his opinion, we don't want to do that. And
well,
they could stop paying you and stop meeting your counsel.
If we have a year's contract with them, in my experience, they will usually do it for a year, and if it's been successful, they will repeat. We had clients for 25 years. We had Procter & Gamble from 1920 to about 1950.
Eddie, I'm sure with all the different clients that you've had through the years that there must have been some difficult ethical questions that came up from time to time. Could you cite an example of that?
I can cite many examples. There are many ethical questions that come up, and I would say it is a very important and a very difficult thing to maintain your own sense of ethics in a world in which the ethics are not as of a higher standard as they should be in all groups of the society. The code of ethics we adopted is...
Now, we in this case was your own firm.
My wife and I. Was that we undertake no activity that we consider to be not in the public interest. Now, a lawyer has to take clients who are crooks because that's his law. But a public relations man, since he is so indelibly linked up with the client, does not have the position of a special pleader who can plead for a crook, because first of all, he pleads in the arena of the broad public that isn't circumscribed by law and by courts of law. Secondly, he becomes the victim or the beneficiary of what he does. He is not disassociated from what he does. Here are some ethical questions that we fortunately handled. Here's one example.
Franco sent a representative to us to see whether we wouldn't handle Franco Spain. Well, the interesting thing to me was that the United States government recognized Franco Spain, but we would have nothing to do with them because I wouldn't think of working with a dictatorship. As another example, Somoza sent a man in to see me. Well, I would no more think of working for Nicaragua than I would for any other dictatorship. And this sort of thing crops up all the time. Let's say, on the other hand, a company comes in and asks us to work with them, and we don't like their policy towards blacks. Are we going to turn down the company because we don't like their policy towards blacks? If that company is a public-spirited company, in other ways, has, for instance, sound employee relations, sound stockholder relations, I would be willing to work with a company like that and work from within, trying to change their attitude towards blacks so they get on a basis of parity. I once remember talking to a group of students of public opinion at Princeton University, where Howard Charles was the professor. He wrote the first bibliography on public opinion, which we helped publish. And one of the students asked me and said, "Mr. Bernays, by what right do you work for music instead of for books?" And I said, "We live in a competitive society, and everything is competing with everything else in the society. If I work for music and get and compete with books, and they sell less books because they sell more music, then the cure for that is for the book people to engage somebody to carry on comparable situation, because, as my friend Bruce Bliven said, the cure for propaganda is more propaganda." So that, to me, was not an ethical question. However, many ethical questions do come up, and they need to be decided on the basis of the individual's own ethical sense of maintaining his amour propre and his self-esteem in a society in which you are judged by your conduct having to do with public interest matters and the public good. In other words, I would never take a client who was selling a drug that was harmful to people, as far as I could find out.
Eddie, you've already given us some good examples of how you have applied social science. I know that there are many examples during the course of your career. Could you give us a couple more examples of how you've solved problems through the direct application of social science?
Well, I can give you a few that are very dramatic. Let me give you one. We were working with a company that had plantations in Central America, and the company had workers who were Indians.
These Indians were nomadic Indians because they found that the land on which they planted their corn, that their corn would give out and they would move to another place, and they became nomadic tribes. So the company said to me, what would you do to change this situation? And I said, well, the first thing I'd do is to send this corn to the University of Iowa and have them develop a hybrid corn that would grow for a longer period than the present corn does. And after a year, the University of Iowa developed a hybrid corn. They took the corn to the Indians, and the Indians refused to use the new corn, even though it was so much better, because they said it would in their procreative powers. Corn was the symbol of their procreativeness. So the company said, well, what do you do now? So I knew that anthropology could come to my aid, and I called up an anthropologist and said, what would you do in a situation like this? And he said, I'd go to the shaman, the head of the religious group of the tribe, and I'd have him bless the corn, and after he blesses the corn, they will use it, and your labor problem will be solved. And that's exactly what happened.
And this overcame their negative attitude
and
towards
it. Well, this obviously, they no longer were nomadic tribes. They were tribes that planted their corn, and it grew, and they were satisfied, and they stayed there. Or I can give you another one.
If we go from this one for a minute now, you mentioned two social sciences. You just mentioned anthropology and husbandry, animal, or working with corn. I don't know what that is, the social science somewhere, farming. How does somebody who's a student now who wants to get into counseling, what would you advise them to study, or how would you advise them to become wise is really what...
What I did was I worked out a program which I gave, and they gave me that plaque up there.
There's so many.
The Association for Education in Journalism had a meeting, and I worked out an educational program, and I said that I felt it was a real mistake to graduate students from the School of Public Communication from undergraduate courses, that nobody ought to be given a public relations degree with an undergraduate course, that what it would take is 2 years of graduate study with a graduate degree that might be called practitioner in public relations, that such a study would include the various subjects I've just named, sociology, psychology, social psychology, anthropology, history, human relations, if you want to call it that, persuasion, if you want to go into that, semantics, linguistics, and that they come out of that with a degree of practitioner in public relations, and that these cute little boys and girls who think they know public relations have been taught for the most part by teachers of English, and to have skills in writing, and what they write may cause completely the opposite effect of what they think it does, because the social scientists have found out that people accept in writing or in print what they a priori accept they reject what they a priori reject, and that unless you project writing in terms of authority, persuasion, reason, tradition, or and emotion, or a combination of them, you may find that your skill in writing has no impact at all in bringing about what you're taught in schools of public relations language does. So that I say, really, to practice public relations the way we're talking now, or the way Frank practices it, and presumably the way you practice it, mean that the individual who comes into the situation has to have a knowledge of goals of the client, has to have a knowledge of human motivation, has to have a knowledge of human attitudes, has to research his subject, and has to help bring about new juxtapositions of actions, attitudes, and words to bring about the end result. If I wanted you to wear a sweater like that, I would not depend on words at all. What I would do is to make a study and find out what motivations get you to accept or reject what you wear.
What is your motivation, Cindy? To stay warm, or?
Well, the motivation might be to stay warm, the motivation might be to be stylish, the motivation might be to spend a lot of money, the motivation might be to be economical, the motivation might be to follow a motion picture star or a society leader, or the motivation might be to dress like one's peers. Unless one knows all those things, one cannot affect attitudes vis-a-vis of attractive sweaters, because one may find that some motivation or some attitude has resisted it. And unless a person is willing and eager to study motivations and attitudes of women of different socio-economic groups, of different age groups, of different social groups, any effort that you may carry out in describing that sweater fitfully and skillfully may have no bearing on an end result, which may be to increase the market.
Honey, today's society is so complex, and it's so important for the public relations practitioner to stay current with today's problems. And how do you do that in order to assist your current and future clients?
Well, a number of years ago, I read a study of the magazines and the periodicals, I'm not talking of books now, that influence the group leaders and the opinion molders of America. And I decided that I would become a vicarious reader and read all of these periodicals so that I would know the same impacts that would affect them, so that if I had to cope with group leaders and opinion molders, which is a very good way to cope with the public, I would be aware of what massages of ideas and facts and relative values they were being subject to. As an example, one of the magazines I have read for the last 50 years is the Library Journal. I read that every week, and I urge you to read it, because the Library Journal puts me 3 months ahead of anybody else in giving me a short, objective review of every important one of the 30,000 books in the United States that's published. Another book I read weekly is the Publishers Weekly, because that tells me what the trends are that are going to make public opinion and public action, because the Publishers Weekly will tell me 8 months in advance that Halberstam is going to get out a book on Time and other journals, and that that will undoubtedly have an impact. That's number two that I read. The third periodical that I read and have read for the last 50 years is Editor and Publisher, because that gives me a very good picture of what happens among the 1,750 dailies and the 7,500 weeklies in the country, and gives me an idea of what the public is subject to and what the basic ideas are. Another magazine I read every week is Variety, because that gives me the channels of escape of the public. If I know that the big motion picture is going to be Star World, I know pretty much what the public is going to be interested in, the imaginative and so on. If, on the other hand, I see that the trend is towards foreign affairs, or I see the trend is towards sports more than it usually is, or I see other trends in the uncovery, I immediately get a grasp of what the conscious and the unconscious is doing in America. If you don't read Variety, you don't know what the public is escaping to or escaping from.
Alvin Toffler of Future Shock fame attaches a lot of importance to movies as a measure of the attitude of our society.
Well, not only movies, but television.
Yes.
And radio are both heavily covered, and videotape now is opening up an entirely new field that nobody knows about, that doesn't read Variety. They had a big section in there that if I were going to live another 10 years, I'd prepare myself on videotape. Now, another magazine that periodically you have to read is the New Republic, because that will keep you in touch with socio-economic, international and national affairs. Another is The Nation, because that is maybe a little bit more to left of middle, but it definitely gives you a very good picture of what the more progressive people in the society feel and want. Another is the Washington Monthly, which I hope you see, which is a very wise and aware journal that tells you things that you never knew till now. Another is Mother Jones, which Mother Jones is a monthly that's published in Texas. Mother Jones was a liberal and is very important to get, because it publishes what others don't publish, and will give you stories that are much more incisive than your friend Wallace on 60 Minutes. And unless you know what's being uncovered, you have no idea of what may happen tomorrow or the day after.
Well, I've been right with you until we got to Mother Jones. That's a new one on me.
Then there are some others of the same general character. But I try to read, five papers a day, not so that I absorb everything in them, but so that you know what different publics are getting, what kind of a picture of the world they're getting, because unless you know that, you can't deal with those publics.
Which five do you read?
I read the Boston Herald American, the Christian Science Monitor, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, and the Wall Street Journal. Then I pick up the London Times to get a feel of Europe, and I pick up the Times Literary Review to get a feel of literature. I read the New York Review of Literature to sort of reinforce my Publishers Weekly and my Library Journal, and that gives me a pretty good picture of being able, more or less intelligently, to discuss a situation when it comes up. When I get a new client, and this may be helpful, let's say I get an insurance company. I got an insurance company one night. I called up the Wharton School of Finance, asked for the insurance professor, asked for the five best books on insurance. And he gave them to me over the telephone. I then had readers who for $5 a night would abstract any book for me and give it to me next morning. And they would give me the book in abstract form. Next morning, I would get five of the best books abstracted with every sound, relevant thought in them. I would read those books before I met the president of the insurance company that I was talking with, and I would usually know more than he did about his own business. I say this modestly, because I know from my experience with key businessmen, one of the biggest chemical companies, once said to me, Bernays, will you do this study for me? How much will it cost? I said, $30,000. He said, do it. And I said, thanks, I'll have it for you in 2 weeks. As I left the office, he said, oh, one more thing. He said, when you give me that study, I want you to abstract a page. Here was a man who was so busy that he didn't have time to read, and he didn't even have time to read what he wanted me to read. But after all, I was in the position of advising him on what to do with the study, so I didn't care very much. But you will very often find that by using that technique, you'll know more than the person you're talking to. And since you also keep informed of new books, I can find out from the Library Journal a good review of a book on banking, let's say. And that book on banking, which is validated for by the reviewer in the Library Journal will tell me that this is the best book thus far. Well, if I read that book before I talk to the bank president, the assumption is that I will know as much as he does in terms of the broad elements that we may be discussing.
Well, Eddie, we thank you for this most provocative, stimulating conversation on public relations counseling.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.